You're listening to Spellbound.
All right, all right, all right. I'm here with Andrew Rader again. He's back in the house.
I'm back.
But we're in different houses again because we're still on opposite sides of the country. So,
yep.
It's not really in the house. We're both in houses.
We're in the houses.
We've got a great two damn white guys for you guys today. That was a lot of guys. We're talking about the origins of the East, what is now India and China, I guess. And Andrew, you're like, you know so much about, how do you know so much about the East and the origins of?
I kind of just know a lot about everything.
That's why you're the fax machine. That was a dumb question.
Be honest, I'm not sure we're experts on the subject, so I'm not sure we should necessarily be talking about India and China, but we're going to go for it anyway.
Here's what I'm fascinated with. I've been researching the earliest complex societies, and you know, there's that migration fork out of Africa, and one goes east and one goes west. Those are the two like primary forks that we see. And the one that goes east supposedly goes into what is now India and China. And those were, as far as I know, like the earliest complex societies. Is that right?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, usually the Middle East is credited with the development of agriculture. I think almost certainly it started in the Middle East first around 11,000 years ago, 9,000 BC.
In Egypt.
Fertile Crescent. So kind of Syria, basically, in northern Iraq.
But wasn't it before that in Egypt? Because I know that the Egyptian kings were considered deities and stuff because they had like...
Oh, yeah. But that's later. Like the pharaohs, the Great Pyramids are 4,000 BC, so like 6,000 years ago. That's a lot later. Okay.
So there's like this ping pong that you see between like the Middle East and Egypt and... what is now India and China, where it's like they're all kind of, it almost seems like they're ping-ponging off each other with development. So it's like Mesopotamia develops agriculture, and then Egypt becomes this huge empire off of agriculture, and then the East takes agriculture and uses it to urbanize and develop complex societies, and then you see complex societies appear in the Middle East after that. Is that the right order?
That's true. It's a lot easier to invent something if you know that it already exists. That's why the development of agriculture in North America, Mexico, and South America, the Andes, is really independent from the development of agriculture in the old world being Europe, Asia, and Africa. So it developed, you know, all the inventions that happen in Eurasia and Africa too, to some extent, especially Northern Africa, which includes Egypt, obviously, were probably influenced by each other. So if some people invented agriculture, then other people said, hey, we could do that too. They saw it happening.
Right, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Spread. And same thing with writing, same thing with metals like iron and bronze and copper. You know, all these technologies, the wheel, once you invent it in some place, so you have like millions of people working together in Eurasia, and it just kind of spreads from one person to the next. And that's why... You know, the old world just had so many more people than the new world being the Americas. So there's more inventions, and the inventions can happen kind of anywhere within that band, and then they'll just spread to other people. Because so for one thing, the technology itself can spread, right? So you can literally like take iron and bring it to another group, or just the idea can spread, which means that we know they're doing something with these metals. We don't know exactly what it is, but let's kind of experiment in that direction, right? And that leads to inventions too. So, or the writing. Right. Like, it's unclear whether writing was invented independently in China or if writing was inspired by the Middle East. So, writing came first in the Middle East, but the Chinese may have, like, realized what the Middle East was doing and said, hey, we could kind of do something like that too, which they independently invented, but the idea was inspired by the Middle East.
Yeah, just like Google versus Bing. Versus whatever.
They already knew it existed, right? So
I guess what's interesting about the East is they were one of the earliest societies to begin trading on a really large scale, right? Like, because they had boats and stuff, and we know we found like their seals and things like that that they used for, you know, to stamp their goods so that people know it came from the Indus River Valley area. And so, like, that was the first form of trade, wasn't it?
Yeah, the Indus Valley civilization is one of the earlier. I don't think it's necessarily earlier than Egypt, but it's definitely the first one in the India area in South Asia. So there's a couple of things that we're maybe conflating as well. You're talking about the people moving in different directions, And there were multiple migrations of like pre-humans, like Homo erectus came out of Africa like 500,000 years ago,
right,
and got as far as India and China. But that wasn't us. That wasn't modern humans. Modern humans came later.
And also they were hunting and gathering.
They were definitely hunting and gathering. Yeah, for sure. But they weren't even humans. Like, it's unclear whether they spoke language. They probably had like a series of complex grunts. And they used tools and they used fire, but not really sophisticated tools. And, you know, it's unclear whether we could have communicated with them. It's unclear whether we could have interbred with them. Like, they were sort of the missing link, so to speak. Right?
We missed that boat.
Yeah, exactly. And then, but modern humans left Africa much later, around 100,000 years ago. It's debated whether it was like 120,000 or 80,000 or whether it was multiple waves or one wave. But most of those people who left Africa, some stopped in the Middle East, obviously, and some stayed in Africa. And other ones mostly kind of went to India, we think. And then a lot of those people may have migrated from like the India region to China and then obviously onto the Americas and Australia and also to Europe. So kind of the people of Europe may have kind of come through India on the way out of Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they could have gone both ways.
That's long, long, long before civilization.
Yeah.
That's a totally different thing. But then there's a lot of interconnectedness between India and Europe.
Yeah.
So later waves of migration brought language. We talked about this before in the language episode where the mm-hmm. European languages basically come from India. They're Indo-European.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jinx.
Yeah. That's another wave. That's much, much later. But it is a wave of migration from kind of India to Europe.
So you even see it in the religions. Like there's mm-hmm. so much similarity. Like Abraham and Brahman are derived from the same root word.
Yeah.
Saraswati, the goddess of nature, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. his consort is derivative of Sarah, Abraham and Sarah. So it's like, and also Abraham had six sons with a concubine named Keturah. And she's like this controversial figure in the Old Testament because she only appears a handful of times. We don't know much about her. But for whatever reason, Abraham had six sons with Keturah and then sent them away out of Israel. And it's believed that those are the Aryans that came in and influenced Hinduism.
Fascinating. So that would actually represent probably a third wave of interaction. And then there's actually a fourth wave as well, which is Alexander the Great and his Greeks who founded civilizations in Afghanistan and northern India, Greco-Bactrian and Indo-Bactrian kingdoms or Indo-Greek kingdoms, and had a lot of interaction with India. And I mean, there's Buddhist statues that basically look like Alexander, and a lot of the Greek ideas of cosmology probably got transmitted to India. Even the idea of halos, for example, on saints got transmitted to India through the Greeks.
Ah.
The days of the week in India and Europe and in Latin, our days of the week basically, are the same. Meaning they're different words, but they represent the same planets or moons or suns, basically.
Right.
Same celestial objects. Yeah, so there's a lot of connection between India and Europe in about four or five different waves of connectivity.
Interesting.
A lot of the languages are the same. Sanskrit, by the way, is kind of like Latin of India. So it's a language that forms the basis of a lot of the later languages.
Right,
just like Latin forms the basis of French and Portuguese and Spanish and Italian and English even.
Sanskrit is also believed to have been influenced by these six sons of Keturah that I was talking about because it shows up at around, it's between 1200 and 1800 BC, the Indo-European influence comes out of India. And it's like, that's like right around the time when, I mean, Abraham, for just to be clear, he's like we don't even know if he existed, but he's very prominent in these writings. And apparently he had six sons that he sent away at that exact time. And they would have come from, I guess, what is now Israel.
Yes. The oldest religious text is actually from India. The Rig Veda, I think, is the oldest one. So, yeah. So in a sense, this like religiosity may have started in India and somehow influenced the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's also the similarity of India worships cows. They're like the cows, like their most sacred animal. And mm-hmm. And before Judaism was monotheistic, the cow was also their chief god. He was called El, which is where they get Elohim in the Old Testament. It's derived from this cow god named El.
Yeah. That's like the golden calf, right?
Or yeah.
Or the big, yeah, yeah.
That's the thing is like the Israelites
they
keep forgetting.
It after Moses comes down the mountain with the tablets.
Everybody keeps telling them there's only one God now. And they're like, but we have like thousands of gods.
What about the golden calf?
Yeah.
What about this giant calf statue? We worked so hard to build it.
Yeah.
And now we have to destroy it.
And we're so superstitious.
It's like pure gold, right? So
yeah. Yeah. So I guess what would be interesting to talk about is what we do know about the origins of India and China. And then we can just kind of do an overview of up till now, present day.
Yeah, sounds good. So India is very different from China in the sense that India's been, it's never like one country. Only since 1947 has India been kind of a unified country over the whole subcontinent, we call it, because basically India was, used to be this continent that was floating through the Indian Ocean and collided with Asia mm-hmm. and pushed up the Himalayan mountains. So it's called the subcontinent. So India has never really been a fully unified country until modern times. And
right. And just to be clear, I don't mean to insinuate that I don't mean to lump India and China together. It's just I'm interested in the East in general, and it seems like China derived a lot from India. So I guess that's kind of the reason I'm asking about them at the same time. It's not that I think they're the same place or anything.
No, gotcha. And they're the two biggest countries in the world. I mean, if you put them together, almost half the world lives between them. So.
Yeah. That's true.
kind of important.
And, let's talk about this.
But India's always been kind of had disunity, really. There was kind of two times in its history where it was almost unified under a single empire. That was the Mughals in the 1500s, which is mm-hmm. like the Islamic, the Muslims from the north conquered most of it. And also the Mauryans around 2,000 years ago, just after Alexander the Great, actually.
Interesting.
They kind of unified India a little bit. But other than that, it's always been mostly kind of like a bunch of different states and a bunch of different religions. India mm-hmm. has a lot of different religions, actually, a lot of different languages. So it's kind of like a confederation, almost like you can think of it like Europe or something like that. It's a confederation of different
states. Oh, yeah.
States.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. And it's pretty rambunctious. It's politics. Which is a good thing in a way. Like, India is the biggest democracy in the world, but it has a lot of differences, you know, throughout the country, right? Whereas China is the poster child, I guess, for the most unified empire on Earth for the longest time.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
China is basically like if the Roman Empire still existed today. So going
yeah,
back
you're
to
right.
2,300 years ago, China kind of unified, and it's pretty much been unified since then.
Wow.
With the same language, the same writing. It's really as if you took the Roman Empire and just had it still around.
I never thought of it that way, but you're totally right.
I mean, it's had different dynasties. It's been conquered a number of times and kind of like the Mongols conquered it and established a Yuan dynasty. But then the Ming Chinese overthrew the Mongols like 50-100 years later and reestablished another dynasty. It's obviously had different kinds of political systems, I guess, and mm-hmm. especially in the 20th century, there was a contest between who were called the nationalists who fled to Taiwan and then the communists who rule today. But
when was communism instituted?
Karl Marx first wrote about it in the late 1800s. In China, there was a communist party from around the 1920s led by Mao Zedong.
So it's pretty new.
Pretty new, yeah. Pretty new. Then there was a civil war in the 1950s. But before that, like before the Second World War, where China was invaded by Japan, large parts of the country, especially the most populous areas in the West, were occupied by Japan. There was a division in the country between the nationalists and the communists. And then after the war, there was a civil war, and the communists won and expelled the nationalists to Taiwan, which actually still has the same flag of the nationalists and it's the same political party and
wow.
still calls itself the Republic of China. Like Taiwan considers itself to be China, and China considers that Taiwan does not exist. There's one China policy. It considers it an island, basically a province of China. So therefore, Taiwan is not in the United Nations because China will not allow them to be. And the U.S. officially doesn't recognize Taiwan as a country because China considers it a province of China. We went on a really long tangent, but basically,
no, that was good.
Trying to explain the differences. Think of China as the Roman Empire that still exists, and India as this patchwork of states, almost like Europe or something like that. It's all these different countries,
yeah.
all these different cultures, and they can, you know, federated together when the British were kicked out to form like basically a union, kind of like the United States in a way, like the states are all different, right?
That's actually a really beautiful picture. They're all like kind of coexisting with their different beliefs and there's not any problems and everybody gives each other their
problems.
Space. Well, I mean, I know that India has problems, but they're not like at war with each other.
Throughout many times there have been there was a lot of bloodshed during the division. Pakistan used to be part of India, basically. In fact, when we're talking about the Indus River civilization, the Indus River flows only through Pakistan and not India at all. So we call it an Indian civilization because Pakistan, like, is part of the Indian subcontinent. It's basically
well, it flows
part of
into
India,
northeast India,
not.
Right?
Pardon
it
me?
Flows into northeast India.
Yeah, it's northeast India. I mean, it's northeast India geographically, but politically, it's a separate country. Same thing with Bangladesh, which used to be part of Pakistan. It's effectively Pakistan and Bangladesh are the Muslim parts of India. Mm-hmm. There's still a lot of Muslims within India, but are the Muslim parts of India that split off from India, from the Indian subcontinent.
Another thing about the Indus River Valley, since we're talking about religion and stuff, they were notoriously... Like, apparently they had no military or anything. They had, like, a citadel in the middle of the city that was, like, a defensive building that just, like, basically big walls. But their walls were their defense mechanism. They didn't have a military or anything like that. There's no like, signs of weapons in the area. Unlike other areas, we find tons of weapons. It was apparently, like, from the beginning, kind of, like, a really peaceful area.
Like Costa Rica. Costa Rica has no military.
To this day?
Yeah. They banished their army in the 1940s or 50s or something.
Wow. Bold move, Costa Rica.
I don't know.
They're like,
that
nobody wants to kill us. They just want to come on vacation here.
This Indus River Valley having no weapons thing sounds a little fishy to me. I mean, one thing is they may not have had super sophisticated neighbors back then to fight with. But, you know, I think that every civilization throughout history has probably had to at least defend itself. So
yeah, no, definitely. I'm not suggesting that they didn't have to. I'm just suggesting that, I mean, to be clear, this was also one of the original complex societies. So people weren't traveling that fast. So it shouldn't really surprise us that they hadn't thought about having a barracks or something like that, you know? But apparently what we do know about them is they were very egalitarian. We know from what we do see, like from their depictions of like paint and stuff like that. I'm not saying that it's always been peaceful or that, you know.
Yeah, something, I think it's in Sanskrit, maybe the word war means desire for more cows.
Huh.
Something like that. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Because that's what you do. You capture the cows from your opponents, right?
That's basically it.
So there's been this exchange of culture between Europe and India for a long time. And then India went through a series of dynasties influenced by religion a lot, like in the south and in Sri Lanka. There was a bunch of Tamil civilizations. In the north, there was like Buddhism originally. But then what's interesting is Buddhism was invented in India, but basically does not exist in India anymore because it was all displaced by other things. Hinduism, obviously, was pretty old, pretty predominant in India today. It's the most common religion. But then Islam came in the late 600s, early 700s, displaced some of it. And you had like a lot of divisions that exist to today religiously in India.
So there's, the Indo-European language, like we were talking about in the language episode, is like, I guess that's what makes it the most easily accessible language, because it's just everybody, there was this ping pong of development, and the Indo-European languages are the most collaborative ones or something like that.
Is that true? I don't know that. I mean, lots of languages are influenced by other ones, like Swahili in Africa is based on local languages, and then also Indian and even Chinese and Middle Eastern languages that came in from the traders. Like Swahili even means shoreline, I think, in Arabic, something like that.
Yeah, but that's like there's a ping pong there too. I'm just saying that language is naturally like, you know, not even just language. It's like with any kind of development, we are all inspired by each other's progress.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And English or, you know, any of those, you know, the Indo-European line is like the most diverse or something.
Yeah, maybe that's true. India was sort of a melting pot, and because of the connections with Europe and the Middle East, definitely spread the furthest, maybe you could say, at least in the ancient world. But
or they were at war the most.
Who is at war?
Well, I was just saying maybe the culmination of all those languages is because they kept on invading each other.
Yeah, a lot of mixing. I mean, I wouldn't say that they necessarily were at war the most, but yeah, there's a lot of connection, and some of that was military, like Alexander the Great, who took his army all the way from Greece to India.
Okay, so some of it was collaborative and peaceful.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
That's good. That's good. Yeah, that's good. Sign of human progress. We're doing good. So today, you know, especially if you're an American, I think it's kind of hard to, I mean, Americans are notoriously bad at geography and history. I know I sure was, you know, there's a number of reasons for that for me personally. But as I've learned more and more about the connection of all these countries, it's just so incredible how many different ways to live there are. It's just, it's just insane. Like, and a lot of the Eastern cultures, you know, come out of ancient India or China, or like, you know, they're all kind of in the same area. So they're, you know, progress spreads. So I guess it shouldn't be surprising, but there's so much that we've learned from that part of the world. And it's just, and you know, coming at it from fresh eyes for me personally, having learned a lot about world history the last couple of years, it's just been so amazing to see how much, even all these years later here in America, how much we've been inspired by the East. And, I think a lot of Americans don't realize that.
Yeah, that's true. The whole world is connected. And I look at human history as a reconnection of people on Earth, because we all started out together in Africa and then sort of spread out throughout the world 100,000 years ago. And then through the process of exploration, all kind of rediscovered each other. That's basically mm-hmm. the whole plot of my book. Premise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't wait to read your book. You keep telling me about it.
Yeah, I have a whole chapter on India and a whole chapter on China. One of the interesting things about China is that China invented pretty much everything.
But then what do you mean?
Europeans oftentimes like took the technology and applied it on a large scale or perfected it and things like that.
Well, it's that same picture of progress we're talking about. Everybody borrows from each other.
China's always been pretty much the largest country throughout history, both in terms of population and area. Actually, the Roman Empire, which obviously existed at the same time as ancient China, was about the same size in terms of its economy, its population, its land area as well. And China called it Da Qin, which actually just means empire, which it kind of literally means China. It's actually the word for China. So
really,
the Chinese called the Roman Empire the China because they really didn't have a way to distinguish between large empire and, you know, different types of large empires. So they considered mm-hmm. the Roman Empire to be the counterbalance to China at the other side of the world. Kind of like keeping Eurasia in balance. Like there's this.
What year are you right now in time?
During Rome. So, you know, 2000 years ago, basically turn of the okay. first zeroth millennium, the first.
So they considered themselves the opposite of Western philosophy.
Yeah. Or the equivalent on the other side of the world. Yeah.
The equivalent.
Yeah. They basically called them China, or basically which meant empire in their language. They were fairly isolated, I guess, from the West. I mean, there was some interaction. There were some travelers, Roman travelers who went to China, some Chinese travelers who went to visit the Roman Empire. But mm-hmm. China was pretty far. Rome had a lot of contact with India. So the Greeks and Romans knew all about India. They sent ships there. Yeah. Indian sailors sailed to Roman-controlled Egypt, traded spices. You know, this is when we think about the age of exploration, like the spice trade and the Portuguese mm-hmm. going out to discover the world. And the reason actually the Spanish sailed out, like Columbus basically sailed to try to find a route to India.
Right.
And to get to the spices. And he actually had a letter with him to the Khan of China, which was like the Mongols. Oh, wow. It didn't exist anymore, but he thought he would find the Khan of China. China consolidated under the Qin dynasty,
right,
which gave China its name, and that was around 300 BC.
Okay.
So
okay,
before the Roman Empire, Rome existed, but it was a small, insignificant city-state. It was kind of during Alexander the Great time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
What is this reference that you're talking about that they considered themselves the Empire of the East?
Yeah, it's just that China's word for, quote, empire was Qin, which is the name for China. So they used that same word for Rome, which they consider to be the equivalent of China on the other side of the world.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I see. They're saying you guys were second.
No, they're just saying you're another one.
Yeah, I see. Okay, yeah.
Yeah,
I see.
You're another one like us. They kind of understood the Roman Empire in Chinese terms as being like us. Similar to us, but on the other side of the world.
That's cool.
China invented almost everything. Partial list of inventions in alphabetical order. Acupuncture, bells, belt drives, coffins, compasses, crossbows, dental fillings, dominoes, ephedrine, fireworks, flush toilets, forensics, gasoline, goldfish, hot air balloons, horse collars, hydraulics, incense, inoculation, iron smelting, kites, lacquer, matches, moldboard plows, nail polish, napkins, negative numbers, noodles, paper, paper money, playing cards, porcelain, printing presses, running water, rubber,
holy crap.
Rudders, silk, speedometers, stirrups, tea, tofu, toilet paper, toothbrushes, umbrellas, and wrapping paper.
Oh my God, I'm thankful for every single one of those things.
And rockets, gunpowder.
Rockets?
Rockets, gunpowder.
Wait, where are these coming from? Oh, you just realized they weren't on the list.
Yeah. No,
you guys are missing a couple.
Missing a couple. There's more. Hey, you know what?
They got busted by the fax machine.
You know what Chinese money said?
What?
First Chinese money in the Tang Dynasty?
What?
Counterfeiters shall be decapitated.
Wow.
All counterfeiters will be decapitated.
Wow. What? That was on the money?
Our money says, in God we trust.
That...
Yeah, I prefer the former. I think our money should say all counterfeiters shall be decapitated.
That is so good.
Yeah.
That would definitely make it a lot safer.
It makes you think twice before printing it.
We would have had no Frank Abagnale Jr. had our currency said that.
Yeah. Although he just used checks. I don't know that. That's, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's true. That's true.
He forged checks.
That is so amazing.
They can say all forgers shall be decapitated too, I suppose.
So why don't we talk about the future of China and India? Because there's going to be a lot of growth there and there's probably going to be a lot of change. Do we know anything about what they're thinking about the future or anything like that?
China's growth is actually the lowest point right now since 2009. It just hit 6%, which is extremely high. But China, for the last few decades, has had pretty much the highest growth rate. Definitely the highest growth rate of any major country in the world. Just a massive export boom. We buy tons of Chinese stuff. They have a dependent relationship on the United States and vice versa. So the United States buys their stuff and we give them money, basically. So China's growth, though, is slowing, but only because they're becoming a more mature economy. They're becoming kind of a more modern economy where people have money and there's more middle class and they're not just, you know, expanding and producing. So China's kind of hitting a natural plateau a little bit, or at least approaching that.
But they're going to get another billion.
Is China going to get another billion?
They're projected to get another. I know India is for sure, and I think China is going to get another billion, and Africa is going to get another billion.
Chinese growth rate in terms of people is not super high. They had the one child policy; they're ending it now because I think the growth rate was actually pretty slow. But India, yes, absolutely,
it's
India
so fast
is
for everyone else
to pass
though.
China like this year.
That's like Justin Bieber saying he's not making any money anymore. It's like, well,
isn't he spending it all on lawsuits?
I don't know. I don't know anything about the guy.
No,
I'm just saying,
know.
Like, it that all seems a little relative.
Yeah.
Right? Am I wrong?
I don't really know, actually, what the Chinese growth rate is. But I think
okay.
it's below,
I don't either.
Two, below the replacement rate currently.
Okay. Yeah, man.
So that would imply that it's actually shrinking.
Well, what's the future look like then?
So India is passing China in population, and they've already passed China in growth rate. So India is kind of similar to China, but a few decades behind in terms of economic growth. So they're increasing their exports a lot. There's obviously a lot of outsourcing. India is actually pretty well disposed to have a lot of development in like technology. Like they're developing their own cars now. Software obviously is huge. And one of the reasons why India is pretty integrated into the global market is because of English. A lot of Indians actually speak English. It's an official language of India, I believe. And, you know, just because of the history with the British Empire, India has the language that, you know, we use. So it's pretty easy for them to move around and work. So India is kind of the new China in a sense that it's now, it now has the highest growth rate of any major country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's starting to, you know, really put out a lot of exports and things like that. So
they're really well positioned. What a time to be.
Yeah.
Number
yeah,
one.
These massive economies go by this acronym BRIC, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and they added South Africa, so now it's BRICS. And the reason they added South Africa is because it made a better acronym than Nigeria. Because I couldn't figure out how to put the N in.
They
invited South Africa.
You're going to sound like just a southerner, not a South African.
Yeah. But there's all these economic groupings for countries that people have, like Mint, which is like Mexico and Turkey. Forget the other two. But anyway, we make all these economic groupings for countries. Anyway, so the future, China has changed dramatically in the past few decades. Like the communists instituted all these policies which basically failed and starved lots of people. But around the 1980s, Deng Xiaoping introduced markets into the country. So he, you know, had private property and you could start selling things. And China's prospects went up dramatically after that. His phrase was, it doesn't matter whether it's a black cat or a white cat, so long as it eats mice. Kills mice, basically. So it doesn't matter whether we call it like communism or not, as long as we have things that work, which is just kind of sensible.
Well, also, you know, there's so many people in China, they might not have a choice but to run on communism. I mean, I know that the more people there are, the more of a market there is, but also there's, you know, I would like to see a statistic on how many innovators there are to non-innovators. So, like, you know, if it's a scale of productivity, then there's always going to be a lot more people that just want to have like a really easy, calm life, just predictable life, than there are going to be people who want to be driving progress and like living kind of, you know, doing that kind of. There's always going to be less innovators, is I guess what I'm saying. So, is it, from an economical standpoint, it seems like maybe they have no choice but to be communism. And that actually lines up with what you were saying earlier about how it's a new idea. So it kind of parallels their growth rate.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think there's ever the disparity that you're talking about. I think it's all about what incentives you have. And I think if you have more people, as you say, you can have bigger markets and you can have more innovators. And there's the opportunity for India, for example, to really drive the future in terms of technological development. And they're coming out with like the Tata car, which is a small, lightweight, inexpensive car. They're starting to export Indian car models. I mean, there's no reason why you can't have innovation with lots of people. You could have like proportionally the same number. And it's just about...
I'm not saying that there's less innovation because I know that there's more by having more people, there's more innovators. But I'm suggesting it's a net negative or something, that like overall there's going to be more people that just want to have a nice suburban predictable, like just work 9 to 5, you know, and then there's going to be people that don't do that, that are, you know, entrepreneurs and things like that are more like risky lifestyles, you know. There's always going to be less people innovating.
Yeah, it sounds like the argument that Europeans made a couple hundred years ago about China, basically they called them like hydro cultures or something, basically because of all the rivers and dams and canals in China. And the argument was that because there were so many people in China, they didn't really need to innovate because inventions are basically about productivity. So you invent something to save time or money or labor. And if you have like so many people, you don't really need to save money and time and labor. You can just like hire a bunch of people to do things manually. So instead of developing like
communism,
a digger that can dig out canals, you just get millions of people with shovels and you can just dig it out with like that.
That way. Sounds like communism.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose, but I don't know that there's a formal theory for connecting communism to large populations. I mean, you can also have, I mean, I guess to some extent, hard times economically, I think, do kind of inspire people towards communism to some extent. That's what happened during the revolution, the Russian Revolution, I guess maybe the Chinese Civil War. But I don't think that's a necessary rule. I don't think that it always happens that way. I think there is the opportunity for, and that's what we see today with India and China, actually moving towards more free markets and more inventiveness and more entrepreneurs. So I think mm-hmm. that it's not really tied to large populations, that you can have innovativeness even in a large economy, a large number of people.
So the population of China went in 1800, it was around 100 million through pretty much all of history, apparently. I'm looking at this now. And then the population doubled from 150 million in 1650 to 300 million by 1800. Mm-hmm. And it reached 450 million by the late 19th century. And that's like communism develops right in the middle of that massive spike.
Yeah, but that massive spike was largely caused by new technologies, new forms of agriculture. So sweet potatoes came from the Americas. Sweet potatoes are the number one, not the number one crop in China, but they're grown in China more than anywhere else. And they're pretty hardy. You can grow them in bad conditions. Even if you have a drought or lack of rice, you can eat a lot of sweet potatoes. So that was like one of the things that I have a whole video about how the sweet potato created and brought down the Chinese Empire, basically.
That's amazing.
Maybe
it's a moot point. Maybe it's a moot point. But it just seems connected to me.
I mean, it's definitely connected to economic hardship, but that isn't necessarily connected to large populations. I mean, just case in point.
They are the largest, and they're the only communists.
Check out the population of Europe in the Middle Ages and compare it to the population of Europe at the 20th century, right?
But Europe is a union.
No, but even in any country in Europe. So the population of Britain, let's like the island of Britain or England, population of England was less than a million probably back in like 1500. And then by the 20th century, it was like 30, 40 million. Mm,
that's
30,
a good
40
argument. Yeah.
Times as many people doesn't make it communist.
That's a good argument. Yeah. Well, maybe there weren't as many consumers back then.
I mean, consumer is actually a new idea as well.
And those are the people I'm talking about. There's always going to be people who want to consume more and people who want to consume, like, who are just more, like, concerned about productivity. So
that sounds
maybe
like you've just described America, my friend.
Consumption. It's the consumers. The consumers don't want to innovate. So that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, but that sounds like America more than a communist country. That's true of every country, I think. That's not...
Well, yeah, but the Chinese are consumers. Everyone's a consumer. It's 2018.
Yeah. Although, like, the consumer society was basically European or American invention, where basically it's mass production and producing lots of stuff, not subsistence. It's like the opposite of subsistence.
What I'm suggesting is that these countries that you're saying that had much bigger populations than China did when China instituted communism, there weren't as many consumers in those times because... That wasn't a viable way of life. You couldn't just be a suburbanite because we didn't invent that for centuries later. So
yeah, but consumerism goes hand in hand with capitalism, not communism.
Yeah, but everyone's a consumer now because it's 2018.
Not everyone around the world, but everyone in the United States.
Yeah, well, everyone pretty much consumes at least agriculture.
Yeah, but that's subsistence. If you're producing your own agriculture, I wouldn't call you a consumer. I would call you a subsistence farmer, which is true of a lot of people in Africa, for example, still, who are just producing their own food and they're not buying things from the outside world.
All right, we're talking about consumption on very relative terms at this point, obviously. We're probably not going to figure it out today, but the connection does seem interesting.
Yeah.
So this is one last thing we can touch on real quick. I feel like places like China get demonized a lot in American media. And I guess it's like when you paint the picture of the history of the world the way that we just did, it's like we've always been at war with each other occasionally, but we've also like gotten along pretty well. So like, do we really need to be worried about China? Like we owe them a lot of money, obviously. And there's a lot of people that are worried about that, but they're like, maybe we can't get to the bottom of this either, but it's just interesting to me how, you know, we've all managed to get along this long. Why should we start being terribly afraid of China right now?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I have different opinions about that. And I mean, obviously, I think to some extent it's tribalism. It's us versus them. So we see them as different. And that's kind of an artifact of humanity growing up as hunter-gatherers. And we saw the other tribes and they were like, oh, what about those guys over there? Right. So it's unclear. But then there's also geopolitical considerations. China obviously has a different government, different style of government. And, you know, we like our free government, basically. So it's, you know, it's unclear, but one thing that is clear is China is assuming more of a leadership role in the world, and they're starting to engage in a lot of economic projects in Africa and things like that.
Well, we're all developing differently.
Yeah. Live and let live.
That's what I think. What do you guys think? More importantly, you guys are the listeners. You guys are the ones with all the power. We want to hear your thoughts. If you want to tweet us, you can do that. I'm at Julian Was Here on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. Although I'm a little slow on social media these days, so if I don't tweet right away, it's not because I don't like it. You can tweet Andrew if you want. At Mars Raider is his handle. He's a little more active on social media than I am, which is probably why he has 2.5 million more Twitter followers than I do. If you're enjoying this show and you want to support us, consider subscribing. It helps us out, and it's a great way for you to not have to remember to do anything. Episodes just show up on your phone. If you feel like going crazy, you can leave us a review or rate us on Apple Podcasts. That's probably the most helpful thing you can do. And if you feel like being unhelpful, just don't do anything. I'm Julian Smith. This has been Spellbound. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you guys next Monday.